Next case is 97-2653, Jeffrey Davidson versus BP American.
Contreras and all those other provisions that we said with regard to the whistleblower statute?
Yes.
It seemed to me that was the argument, that they didn't, and therefore there was no cause of action.
There was an argument, Your Honor, first of all, the question of where is that there are numerous written reports in the record. There are numerous written memorandums, there are numerous emails.
But that gets us right to the issue of... Let's get right to the issue of, because it bothers me, let's start with BP. BP didn't fire him, did they? So your claim against BP is that they interfered with his contractual relationship.
Yes.
Okay. But BP is not his employer at all.
BP is a former employer.
BP is not his employer for purposes of this case. At the time he was fired, he was employed by Coopers.
Correct.
So what kind of cause of action could you have against BP?
BP should be held liable because it advised, encouraged, promoted, controlled, or abetted the wrongful conduct of another under a joint liability theory.
Well, that's your theory and that's your allegation, but they specifically said that they never even talked to Coopers about his discharge. That's the deposition I read.
Well, it is true that the defense denied that it was responsible for the discharge, just like in many cases the defense denied that it discriminated against an individual. And this is a very important point, Your Honor, for a number of reasons. First, I would be remiss if I did not mention that the United States Supreme Court decided a case just a few weeks ago, the Harlow case at 119 Supreme Court 489, decided in December 14th of 1998, that is very similar on the facts regarding a tortious interference claim and a civil conspiracy claim, where parties conspired, former employers and current employers conspired to terminate and retaliate against an individual who was attempting to comply with federal law.
But there was evidence in that case that had occurred.
Right. Now, with respect to the evidence, Your Honor, so legally, I think I would be remiss if I did not mention that case, I believe, is critical to this court in reviewing multiple claims. The tortious interference claims, the civil conspiracy claims, the public policy.
Okay, let's leave BP.
Well,
let's leave BP for a minute and go to Coopers, because that's really where the issue is here. Coopers says very clearly they fired him for other reasons. And that's always the case in wrongful discharge cases. But here, he walked right into another job and never lost any income at all. What is his damage?
Well, there is an expert report on the record there's two expert reports that were totally ignored. One is an expert report that reviewed the tax implications of filing. There's another expert report that reviewed the damage to Mr. Davidson's career, which was substantial, both economic and with respect to his opportunity for employment, his opportunity for similar employment, and that is detailed in the record.
Did your client ever report this to the IRS?
Yes, sir.
And so is he in that program that he gets a percentage of what they might recover?
Yes, sir.
I see.
Your Honor, with respect to...
When did he do that? Sometime after he was let go by Coopers, is that right?
Yes, sir. With respect to the evidence that's established in your question about the tortious interference, there is evidence that Mr. Davidson repeatedly urged BP and Coopers to comply with tax law, both of them, and there was reporting to both of them, and there's evidence in the record. The lower court held that reporting by email was not a sufficient report, that could not constitute a written report. There was also evidence, so he replied orally and in writing for years. There is evidence that both Coopers and BP met. Mr. Easton and Mr. Frick met in Mr. Easton's office to discuss this threat to go to the IRS. Both Mr. Easton and Mr. Frick admit that they met. They discussed the threat to go to the IRS. Mr. Easton came out of his office and announced that the problem in Columbus has been taken care of. There were witnesses that overheard this at the first meeting, and Mr. Easton admitted on pages 52 and 55 in his deposition that there was a meeting, and he did come out, and he did say, the problem in Columbus has been taken care of. There is evidence that Mr. Davidson was reprimanded and threatened with termination if he discussed this matter any further, and that Mr. Eisendorf reported that to Mr. Prince, who admitted that the sanctions that were the opponent of Mr. Davidson did in fact occur.
I'm hearing from you, Counselor, a whole lot of facts in this case that you want us to accept your interpretation of instead of what the court interpreted. I'm hearing a lot of the fear on that, and that's not really our function. What proposition of law are you proposing to make?
We are asking that starting the claims of the mean something in the state of Ohio.
But if you claim that your client follows the merits and follows all the requirements of the whistleblower to ask you, if you claim he did that, then I'll give this back to you.
We did not appeal. We are not here about whistleblower objection. We did not appeal to whistleblower objection. We are here because the Court of Appeals of Ohio Home and County effectively reversed this court in finding that there was no claim as a matter of law when there were multiple sources of public policy, multiple sources, innumerable, with respect to reporting requirements, compliance with tax laws, the state of Ohio, I mean, numerous sources of public policy, accountants, obligations. What happened is that the Ohio County Court of Appeals ignored the decision in Culp. Completely ignored the decision in Culp, ignored the decision in Culp, and found that Mr. Davidson, because he did not comply with the whistleblower statute, had no public policy claim. And that's why we are here.
Didn't Culp say that there had to be full compliance with the whistleblower statute before there is another cost
of action? Culp absolutely did not say that. Culp said that this was that there were multiple sources of public policy, that in order to, if you're talking about it, in order to get the benefit of the whistleblower statute, were there other sources of public policy, and Culp went on to enumerate, 10 or 15 different statutes regarding workplace safety, just as this court did in Palma, where it enumerated sexual imposition crimes, saying that there are multiple sources of public policy, and we are not reliant, and have never been reliant on the public policy which is in the whistleblower statute. However, if the question is, would this class, if we recognize the public policy with respect to protecting those who want to get employers to comply with tax laws, that would in no way hinder the public policy found in the whistleblower statute.
Then explain to me, maybe I'm misinterpreting the syllabus of Culp, syllabus 3, this state, I don't read it all, but it says, so long as that employee has fully complied with the statute, and of course they're referring to the whistleblower statute, what does that mean then? And syllabus 3, fully complied with the statute,
I what I understand it to mean is that in order to in order for the really claim to be premised on public policy in the whistleblower statute, then you must have complied with the whistleblower statute. However, there are other sources of public policy. There are multiple sources of public policy. And even if Mr. Culp did not comply with the whistleblower statute, there are multiple sources of public policy, and they are enumerated in detail.
So an individual has a choice of whether to proceed with the whistleblower statute or the common law cause of action.
Well, Culp states very clearly that these are cumulative remedies and that there is no preemption. There is a long discussion in Culp that went back to the Trader dissent and has gone back for many years to Helmut about preemption and whether or not this is a cumulative remedy. And since we have multiple sources of public policy that are critical, I guess, to the extreme, even with respect to the paychecks of those honorable justices before us, the Army, the military, the judiciary, and what could be more important than the collection of taxes? So, Culp says very clearly that there is no preemption, this is not cumulative, and that the question, there is a claim, and it was pronounced really in Tanker and in Collins and long before Culp, and Justice Holmes erred in holding that this was that we were preempted, or that because we had not complied, according to Justice Holmes, was
Counsel, may I ask, my problem with it, I think the argument is, this is a gentleman whose claim is he was discharged because he was about to blow the whistle about taxes. Albeit it taxes, the whole idea of public policy, we encourage paying taxes. But nevertheless, isn't this like exactly right on about the whole point of a whistleblower statute in the first place? If that is the case, that this gentleman says it was because I was going to blow the whistle, and we say, well, even though we said you must comply with the whistleblower statute in order, or all the prerequisites in order to get the benefit of that statute, why have such a statute if we're going to say, because in every whistleblower case there's going to be some unlawful conduct. If it's unlawful, it's against public policy typically. So we've obviated the whole point of having such a statute and requiring compliance, haven't we?
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I realize these are questions and arguments that you have made before, that have been made before, and that have been rejected by the majority of the court. So what we are here about is precedent and very decisive. Now, I understand that there is a view that there's a statute right now, and therefore the judiciary does not have a right or an obligation to modify or enlarge or to speak about the common law, because
Language. You're talking about preemption, and because really what you're saying is these remedies are not mutually exclusive, which is different than preemption.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So
what you're...
I
understand. I know a little bit about culture. But where you are with this case is, and that's why I asked you right off about the whistleblower statute, and I think that's probably why Justice Resnick continued it, because that was a concern. You are here under the whistleblower statute. You're here under the common law Greeley cause of action.
But we didn't even appeal the whistleblower.
And at this point, you haven't even used the term Greeley yet in your whole presentation. That's what you're here for, aren't you? Oh, okay.
The red light came on before you got there. Thank you. Mr. Marcus.
Decided to then your fact that the BP thought the continued barrier, there was really no way to bottom down, so to say again. Is that sort of ground
level? BP America did its own taxes, like a lot of corporations do, they have large corporate tax departments. And they decided, you know what, we can save money, we'll hire an outside accounting firm to do that. And that just outsourced the entire department. Part of the deal was that we don't want to be said, look, we have these good employees here, we don't want to have to lay them off. You must, as a condition of this contract, offer jobs to all of these people. Interestingly and significantly, Mr. Davis, the local, offered the opportunity to continue to work on the BP engagement, doing essentially the same thing he had done before, elected not to. He said, no, thank you. I'm up to here with BP and their taxes. What I would really like to do is move back to Columbus, Ohio, where my mother lives, my father having passed away recently, and I'd like to start a career in public accounting. He found an advertisement in the Columbus Dispatch, coincidentally, by Cooper's and Library looking for a tax manager in the Columbus office. And he says, hey, I don't want to work for you in Cleveland on BP, but what about this job opening in Columbus? The answer is, fine, you're told you're a fine accountant, we're told you're a quality individual, by all means, we'll put you in that position. Now, the agreement he signed with BP to keep their secret, that was an exchange for the early retirement incentive program. In other words, even though he didn't lose a job, even though he didn't miss a paycheck, because he was severed from BP, BP said, fine, we will give you a substantial severance package. But the string is, you have to agree not to sue us, and you have to agree again to keep our secret. The agreement he had made at the time he was originally hired.
Okay, now that sounds like a strong defense. But isn't that what it seems to be? They've got one scenario as to what motivated all of this. You have another look, very plausible and strong explanation, but that really never got to stop.
Well, just to suggest, Your Honor, the trial court did make the determination that Cooper's and Librand had articulated a legitimate non-discriminatory reason for Mr. Davidson's discharge, thus putting the onus on Mr. Davidson to come forward with some evidence that says, no, that's merely a pretext. And the court said on that issue, he came out completely flat. All that he provided the court with was conjecture and speculation, no evidence. So that determination, made in the context of the original promissory estoppel claim, is nonetheless a finding that sort of moots everything else. The court determined that Cooper's stated reason for the discharge was in fact legitimate, and that Davidson could not rebut that legitimate reason. Frankly, that reason alone. That was made on summary judgment, exactly, Your Honor, on the basis that the plaintiff had not met his burden of offering evidence sufficient to overcome the evidence that had been offered by Cooper's and Librand and BP.
I think you just probably stated partly answer, but I'd like to hear your argument. Your argument on why this is not a Greeley case, the law, under the Greeley test or culture.
Again, let me be very clear. As I read Culch, the court was very careful to say, if your public policy Greeley claim is based on the public policy favoring whistleblowing, then if you comply with the Whistleblower Act, then, in addition to the remedies available under the Act, you're entitled to the additional remedies available in the Greeley claim.
So that's the connection between the Whistleblower Act and Greeley.
That's right. This court determined that those remedies are cumulative. On the other hand, the court clearly said, if you don't comply with the Whistleblower Act, then you are not entitled to a Greeley claim unless you can cite some totally independent source of public policy as in OSHA's anti-retaliation.
Now why is their allegation that BP was not reporting its taxes correctly and attempting to cover it up and so forth? Why is that not an independent public policy issue?
Well, it doesn't meet the clarity requirement, Your Honor, on the comparative test. I think the best way of illustrating that is to look at the laundry list of statutes that the plaintiff cites in the hope that one of them may be enough. The fact of the matter is that the fact that they cannot identify a single government pronouncement of the statute, regulation, or otherwise, that clearly says employees should be protected from retaliation for speaking up about alleged tax impropriety. Instead, all they can say is the public policy favors paying taxes, the public policy against committing crimes, the public policy in favor of reporting criminal activities. Those are precisely public policies that are addressed within the Whistleblower Act. That's what the legislature intended to cover.
Your argument is that there has to be some indication that a person cannot be recriminated against. Bad English, but there can't be some recrimination against an employee for revealing or reporting.
Yes, the cases that have been decided so far, when you talk about clarity and then sort of moving directly into jeopardy, those are the critical elements. That there has to be some public policy, the policy which will only be vindicated through the prosecution of this type of claim. If we don't allow the plaintiff to create a grievance claim here, then we've created a public policy anomaly. And here, of course, the remedy that was available to Mr. Davis, that would have been a full and complete remedy when added to the grievance claim, would have been if he had complied with the Whistleblower Act. He did not. That was his mistake. As a consequence, his grievance claim goes out the window because the only public policy site that.
Well, but is that true? We're already done with the whistleblower. You say that's all he cites is the whistleblower. But in fact, there is a public policy about us paying taxes, isn't there? There clearly is. And didn't, what was the name of that other case that overruled Tula? Painter versus Grayley. Didn't Painter versus Grayley specifically say that rises to the level of it? You're standing here telling us this morning there has to be a specific statute that says, that he can point to, that says everybody should pay their taxes. That's not what those cases say.
What we have to be careful about is that if you have to be careful not to create a rule that swallows up the statute. Because if you say, so long as you can cite some underlying criminal statute, then you can justify the really claim independent of the Whistleblower Act. You've written the Whistleblower Act out of the...
No, you really haven't, because you can have an independent cause of action under the Whistleblower Act. If you follow those specific criteria, and you and I agreed, I think, at the start of your presentation, this is not a whistleblower case, this is a Greeley case. And if it's a Greeley case, if it rises to the level of a public policy, then they have a common law cause of action. All the cases say that.
You're right, Your Honor, but you also indicated in Culch that the legislature was very careful in enacting the Whistleblower Act, that it was going to provide a public policy claim, a whistleblower claim, in certain circumstances, but not in every circumstance.
But, Counselor, they were claiming under the whistleblower statute in Culch.
And the court determined that he had, in fact...
He had not complied. He had not that he had to go through the complete compliance. Here, there, that's why I was surprised that Simon's answer when she said, oh, yeah, we comply with the whistleblower statute, because I don't read it that way. But in any event, her cause of action is Greeley, not whistleblower, and I think that's what the Chief Justice is getting to. Why isn't it a public policy that we should all pay our taxes?
It may be, Your Honor, but that's the same. A claim that says, I threaten to blow the whistle on the non-payment of taxes invokes the public policy that is itself the Whistleblower Act. And the court was clear in saying, if you're going to rely on the public body, on the policy embodying the Whistleblower Act, you must comply with the action. If I may, in half a minute I have left before I step on this discussion, I'd also like to stress our proposition of law dealing with the issue of confidentiality, because this also deals directly with the Whistleblower Act. In the Whistleblower Act itself, the legislature was careful to say that the Act does not permit disclosures that would diminish or impair the rights of any person to the continued protection of confidentiality in communication. In other words, they struck a balance. Yes, we favor public disclosure, but not at the expense of the violation of a duty of confidentiality. That is precisely what Mr. Davidson threatened to do in this case. So even if he had a grievance claim, that grievance claim would have to be tempered by the fact that what he was threatening to disclose was confidential information that is referred to him in a confidential relationship pursuant to a written confidentiality agreement and as protected by both state and federal statutes.
Was there a summary judgment on that issue? So the court says the remedy is available pursuant to RC 4113.52 for violations of the statute. And the remedy is available for the tort of wrongful discharge is human.
Correct.
So the five says an escrow employee who is discharged or disciplined in violation of 4113.52 may maintain a statutory cause of action for violation, a common law cause of action for this settlement, or both. But it's not entitled to double income.
Right. So if he complies, this is a law rather. And he's not real going to this in violation of that statute. In other words, in violation of the Whistleblower Act. Mr. Davidson was not discharged in violation of the Whistleblower Act.
What do you mean if he complies?
Well, if the bill defies that, an at-will employee who is discharged or disciplined in violation of the Whistleblower Act may maintain both rights. The boss has been discharged in violation of the Act. Mr. Davidson, again,
if you haven't violated the Whistleblower Act, then you have no common law cause of action.
Yeah, under Silva 5, you don't. Under Silva 5, you're dealing only if you have whistleblower. Again, the situation where if you comply,
but only relates to the fact that you can maintain both, but you can't have another income. Right, all it says.
Exactly. Over again, if you knock your eyes and lost the teeth, you get both the statutory remedies and the common law.
And that's what this fellow did. He brought both. He lost on one, and we're here on the other.
He's right. He did not knock his eyes, and he didn't cross his teeth. So he has no Whistleblower Act, and therefore he cannot base a public policy or claim on the public policy in the Whistleblower Act because he didn't comply with it.
Well, I think we understand that.
Okay.
Public policy. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Gerber.
Saying. As I read syllabus one, which is the one that nobody talked about so far. It says, an at-will employee who is discharged or disciplined for filing a complaint with, in that case, a motion. It is the filing of the complaint. It is the bright line that all of us can see. All of us can advise our clients. There's a bright line. If you're going to file a complaint, we will let you not have to follow the whistleblower statute in telling your employer in writing.
You didn't find that confusing, did you?
No, I did not.
Me either.
Number one, the easy one. Jeffrey Davidson did do a thing. This is the wrong thing to be talking about. Extended situations. We have a situation in which an employee did not follow the whistleblower. We gave him one right, he didn't follow it. We have a situation in which he didn't file a complaint. If he is here to vindicate the right of all those who wish to protest, those who didn't pay taxes, let him take the steps to file a complaint. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Simon, you've used your time, but you can take 30 seconds.
Confusing at all about the coach opinion whatsoever, particularly if one looks at the backdrop of the public policy exception to Plaintiffville in Ohio, beginning with Funk, looking at the statute, looking at Greeley, looking at Collins, looking at Hanker, and looking where we are today. The coach opinion is completely clear.
So, Ms. Simon, why was Mr. Davidson, why does he claim he was discharged? Not because he went ahead and paid some taxes that ought to have been paid. Not because going through your list of potential public policies, not paying taxes. You know, he's not claiming he was fired for any of those reasons, that he was doing something the law required and the employer didn't like it. One reason that he really claims was he was about to tell on them.
That's not in accordance with the facts, Your Honor. The facts are that for years, he consistently urged his employer to comply with the tax law.
I understand, but he's not claiming that that's why they fired him, because that went on for many years.
Yes. Well, that culminated and he urged both Beatty and Cooper to pay the taxes that he owed.
But the urging
culminated in a threat to go to the IRS. And then he was discharged. There are many facts that led up to the discharge. There is evidence that supports that this is a tortuous, wrongful discharge in violation of clearly expressed and very important public policy of the state of Ohio.
Thank you, Ms. Simon. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.